Well, clearly, we have to have some sense of what the diplomatic process is going to look like. And there's nothing that I could see, and I mean literally nothing, in the Singapore summit that gives any clues of what that's going to look like. Obviously, there's going to have to be follow-on. This meeting at this level was one of the first. You had two meetings that Secretary Pompeo undertook with Kim Jong-un directly, and then you had the team that Mira referred to, led by Sung Kim. But this is a process which is going to go on for months, if not even years.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, June 12th, 2018. On Tuesday in Singapore, after doubts about whether the summit would happen, President Trump met for several hours with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, culminating in a joint declaration between the two heads of state. Just after the declaration dropped, North Korea experts Mira Rapp Hooper, a senior fellow at Yale's Paul Tsai China Center, and Steph Haggard, a professor at UC San Diego, joined Benjamin Wittes to help make sense of the news. They talked about the substance of the summit, how it impacts the U.S.'s security alliances in the Asia-Pacific, and what might come next for the U.S.-North Korea relationship. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 320, Mira Rapp Hooper and Steph Haggard on the Singapore summit.
Let's start with the text of the declaration itself, because that seems to be what the summit accomplished. Steph, get us started. What did the parties to these talks agree to, and how significant do you think any of it is?
I guess the first thing I would notice about the declaration is it's surprisingly short and surprisingly vague, which suggests to me that the prior discussions leading up to the summit didn't accomplish all that the teams expected that they might. So it's basically four very brief points, committing to establish new relations between the United States and the DPRK. That's obviously aspirational because normalization would be a far way down the road. Efforts to build a peace regime. We know that that's a piece of this, but again, pretty far down the road. A comment about the return of remains, which seemed to have preoccupied the president in his press conference. But the main point is point three on denuclearization. And here I want to parse this a little finely, maybe too finely. But the exact language is reaffirming the Panmunjom Declaration, the DPRK commits to work toward complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. It's a one-sentence claim. And it's got three things in it that are potentially worrisome. One is, by reaffirming the Panmunjom Declaration, it means that the North Koreans have put this in the context of that declaration. And the main thing in the Panmunjom Declaration is a statement that war will not take place. So it's a peace kind of document. Second, the DPRK commits to work toward complete denuclearization, but does not commit to denuclearization. And then finally, and I think Mira can speak to this, this whole question of the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, as opposed to the restatement of the CVID, complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization, that struck me as a big omission.
Mira, what did you think? Is the declaration, is there more to be said for it than Steph gives it credit for, or is it really a weak statement?
I think it's really a weak statement, Ben. I will note that I was definitely expecting something flimsier, and this is even emptier than I would have expected. In particular, I'd love to dig down on point three, and that is the part of the statement that invokes the Panmunjom Declaration and commits the DPRK to, quote, work towards complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. This entire summit in the making could be written through the history of how each one of these parties has defined or not defined denuclearization over the course of the last few months. And in many ways, it is that ambiguity that allowed them to even get to this point. So the United States and top government officials have for the last several months been defining denuclearization as the complete, verifiable, and irreversible dismantlement of North Korea's nuclear weapons program when they have been pushed to offer a definition. However, the North Koreans, Kim Jong-un and his father and grandfather before him, have generally had a completely different interpretation of what denuclearization means. It generally means a commitment by North Korea to work towards denuclearization in exchange for the removal of the military threat from the United States, which is to include the end of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and the removal of troops from the Korean Peninsula. So these two definitions of denuclearization have been allowed to coexist throughout this diplomatic process to allow these parties to get into the room together. But the remarkable thing is that this supposed objective is still not defined coming out of the summit. In the phrasing in point three that we see, we've actually seen the American definition and the North Korean definition elided into one. So we now see working towards the, quote, complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Complete denuclearization is the U.S. turn of phrase, and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is the North Korean turn of phrase. So this ambiguity that was useful to permit diplomacy to move this far is now more problematic than it's ever been, because it surely does not provide a roadmap forward to this all-important objective.
So let's talk about this this outcome in terms of the optics of the event. President Trump set this up in a kind of maximalist fashion, right? I mean, going from fire and fury tweets to I'm going to have a kind of personal meeting at which we're going to establish a great relationship. And to have all of that drama leading up to something as empty as this statement, I could see arguing that that is a sort of dramatic failure of Trump's kind of personal presidency diplomacy. On the other hand, you can say, well, they're engaged in a process now, and it's a and that process is itself de-escalating tensions, which were very high only very recently. So should we understand this as very modest progress, but still progress, or should we understand it as, as a failure?
I'll jump in here, Ben, and say that I think it can be a bit of both at once, but that it's terribly important to keep in mind the context in which this summit took place. So while it is very common and strictly true to say that a summit, however empty, is strictly preferable to threats of nuclear war, and I would associate myself with that inequality unabashedly, it's worth noting that the reason we were terrified of a war on the Korean Peninsula just a few months ago is because the President of the United States was largely making those threats. So I think as analysts, we have to be careful not to award too many points for slightly mitigated lunacy by way of a fairly flimsy summit. That said, I think it's also important to observe what has happened with respect to the objectives of this summit in just the past few weeks. So as you say, Ben, going into the summit, the objectives began as quite maximalist. When President Trump accepted the invitation, he and his top advisors who were working in the North Korea portfolio made clear that they were looking for denuclearization in one fell swoop. And I think any expert who knows the situation knew that that was completely unrealistic, that the best anyone could have possibly hoped for was that the summit would go reasonably well and lead to a tangible process that would allow negotiations to continue at lower levels, thereby implementing a set of meaningful restrictions on North Korea's nuclear and missile program. But not only did Trump in the last few weeks define downwards his objectives for this particular summit by way of it being a one-shot deal at unilateral nuclear disarmament, he actually defined downward the objective with respect to nuclear weapons altogether. If you look at his statements in just the last few weeks, he has moved the goalposts to argue essentially that the objective of this summit was to establish a strong interpersonal relationship with Kim Jong-un, to improve bilateral relationships, and to get to know one another. And while that stronger relationship theoretically could be a permissive condition to a more serious process that would allow arms control to take place, we do not see anything in this declaration or attendant statements that lay out for us either what the process will look like going forward or the interim policy objectives that the two actors involved will be trying to obtain. So while, again, strictly speaking, flimsy diplomacy is better than threats of war, I think we need to hold ourselves accountable to the comparisons that we're making.
Yeah, let me follow that, Ben, if I could. There's a downside and an upside to building personal trust. The upside is the possibility to see bargains that weren't previously there. The downside is the possibility that you become too empathic. And weirdly, I think what comes out of this summit is that Trump is not a particularly good negotiator. He tends to identify with his counterparties, at least when they're autocrats, and kind of take their point of view on the world. And so what worries me a little bit here is too much has been given away. Let me give a perfect example. He actually referred to U.S. exercises on the Korean Peninsula as provocative. And these are defensive exercises that the U.S. has conducted as a means of sustaining the extended deterrent. In what sense are they provocative? So the trust issue, I think, you know, has two sides. But the second point I want to make is about what summits do. I mean, typically what a summit would do was reach some sort of preliminary agreement at lower level negotiations and then use the power of the chief executives to break log jams on important details and come up with trades. And what we see here is just the absence of that altogether. There isn't any detail. There's not any sense of what a framework would look like. We don't have a timeline, for example, which I think everyone would have liked to have seen. How long is this going to take? Do we have any deadlines? And it seems to me that the summit was wasted in that regard because you had two leaders together, but they weren't allowed to take those kinds of decisions because the work hadn't been done.
Let's talk about the announcement on those exercises, because that's not in the statement in the communique, but it does seem to be an outcome from the summit. Steph, how do you evaluate it, and how troubled or not troubled should we be by it?
Well, first of all, as with this administration more generally, it's hard to know whether this is real or not. As Mira already noted, the USFK already has openly stated, U.S. Forces Korea Command has already stated that they've received no guidance on this, which means that they are going ahead assuming that the fall exercises will go ahead until told differently. So it's possible that this is something that would ultimately get walked back. But there are two or three things that the president said that revert to campaign style form. One is that all of this is very expensive and that the South Koreans aren't paying their share. Number two, he even went so far as to say that the soldiers should get out of Korea, meaning altogether, which of course is just a windfall both for the North Koreans and frankly for the South Korean left, which has long wanted to see a lighter alliance footprint. And then, as I suggested, to say that these exercises are provocative seems to me to fundamentally misunderstand the nature of the alliance relationship at its core, which is essentially defensive.
Mira, I on the one hand, the South Koreans have been extremely forward-leaning in their pushing exactly this kind of diplomacy, although presumably less, you know, personal than the Trump version of it. But they really want this dialogue to happen. On the other hand, in any other context, you would say we just stabbed an ally in the back. How should we understand what the president did with respect to the exercises?
I think it's an example of, you know, something that I and many other experts have been referring to ever since North Korea appeared to be on the precipice of testing its first ICBM, which is an example of alliance decoupling. The situation that obtains when the ability of an adversary to threaten a security provider, in this case, the United States, allows that adversary to pry a ally away. So in this case, the central concern is not simply that Trump made a concession. It's that he did it without consulting the ally. Exactly as you indicate, Ben, there is some chance that President Moon would have been perfectly happy to negotiate over the nature of U.S. ROK exercises on the Korean Peninsula. He is a reasonably conciliatory guy who's in favor of engagement and is representative of the South Korean left in that regard. But to do so in a way that clearly did not involve consultation with our South Korean allies and clearly did not involve consultation with the U.S. military suggests that the United States cannot be trusted as a security guarantor because it's just made a unilateral decision that ultimately implicates the national security fate of one of our closest allies that does not in and of itself have the ability to protect itself. So symbolically, it is deeply important and quite disturbing. And on top of that, I'll note another thing, which is to say the fact that this exercise concession appears to have come out of left field makes it all the more destabilizing. Precisely because the exercise cancellation does not appear in the joint declaration, and because the South Koreans and U.S. forces had no notice, that raises the chances that some modification to this concession will be made later. That is to say that Trump or some other high-level official will backtrack on the promise to have canceled the exercises entirely out of a concern for readiness of U.S. and South Korean forces. Perhaps they will update that concession to be some kind of modification as opposed to cancellation of the exercises altogether. But when that happens, that will become a pretext for Kim Jong-un taking some type of destabilizing retaliatory action in return. The action-reaction cycle that we've become all too familiar with on the Korean Peninsula over the course of the last 30 years. So this is a particularly dangerous set of relationships in which to wade into a thicket not only of forward-basing concerns and alliance politics, but in which to make concessions on which Trump himself has not done his homework.
Steph, if you were a U.S. ally in that region, and you saw the sequence of events in which the president goes from the G7, where he agrees to a communique, has a public fight with Justin Trudeau that causes his top aides to be saying on national television that there's a special place in hell for the Canadian leader, flies to Singapore, makes a big show of this warmth with Kim Jong-un, and then produces a declaration like this and accompanies it with a side drive-by cancellation, we think, of the military exercises, which he doesn't consult with you about. How would you read it? Like, what would be your advice to your government about dealing with the United States?
Well, the first thing to state, obviously, is that South Korea and Japan have both been here before. I mean, this isn't the first example of this kind of Trumpian diplomacy. Let me just cite, you know, two quick examples. The South Korean alliance has been in the president's crosshairs since during the campaign. And so the theme that they're underpaying, that the alliance is not worth it, I mean, that language has been heard before. And to cite a somewhat different example with respect to Japan, the Prime Minister Abe desperately sought to get the TPP back on track early in the Trump presidency, only to see that effort more or less implode. So they've been here before. But I think to answer the question requires differentiating a little bit between Abe and Moon, because, of course, they're quite different political creatures. From President Moon's perspective, oddly, this summit might be seen as a success if we strike out the question of the alliance relationship, which could very well get back on track. For example, it makes direct reference to the Panmunjom Declaration. It puts him arguably back in the center. It provides opportunities for President Moon to perhaps take initiatives he otherwise wouldn't have taken, even if those aren't exactly where the U.S. would necessarily want to go. I think the party that's most isolated by this this summit is actually Prime Minister Abe, because he's long been to the right of President Moon in terms of how North Korea should be approached. And I think this is going to be read from his perspective as a particularly weak agreement, since the nature of the comments about the Korean alliance with Korea could easily be extended to the president's views of the relationship with Japan.
All right, let's zoom out for a second here and talk about the macro diplomacy that's happened here, because, you know, Trump has been for a long time advertising a kind of personal style in which you don't have to do any of the preparatory work, you don't have to everything depends on the sort of personal chemistry and deal making between him and his interlocutors. And this strikes me in the aggregate as a pretty good test of that. So Mira, help me out. You know, I can see how somebody would say, you know, we got from a situation where there was missile testing on a regular basis, there was rapid development, to a situation in which there are smiles and flags next to each other, and that may be distasteful, but it's highly desirable from a, you know, comparative point of view, as even you acknowledge. On the other hand, there's something really gross about this, and something that does not feel like the highest traditions of U.S. foreign policy. So how do we understand the Trump foreign policy style in terms of both the substance and optics of this summit?
It's an essential question, Ben, because I think in a lot of ways what the Singapore summit really was a real-time test of a more general Trumpian foreign policy hypothesis, which is to say that by functioning in this highly unpredictable and chaotic manner, could this U.S. president cow allies and adversaries alike into turning over major concessions, reshaping the board to the U.S. advantage in light of all the chaos he had fomented, right? That's sort of his operating principle in foreign policy in a lot of ways. And we saw this all play out in real time over the course of the last couple of months. Whether it was his incredibly impulsive decision to accept the invitation in the first place with no prior diplomatic preparation, to the halting fact of the preparations being on again and off again, with even White House staff unsure of whether the summit was on track, to Trump himself calling off the summit to get Kim Jong-un to want it more. There was nothing about this that was recognizable as normal U.S. foreign policy. Indeed, it was only in the last 2 weeks of preparation where we saw for the first time three veteran Asia hands tapped to go to the border town of Panmunjom to start working with their North Korean counterparts on an incipient framework agreement, work that should have been done over the course of the last several months, and that had they been given more time, might have resulted in much more material foreign policy gains, concessions from the North Koreans that the United States and the international community could actually pocket to make the world safer. What's more, I think it's also pretty obvious that throughout this process, the president was almost relishing his own lack of preparation. He said in several public statements the fact that he needed only his own instincts, his touch and feel to know whether he was going to be able to build a relationship with Kim Jong-un. And widespread reporting suggests that the White House did not give its veteran negotiators the political backing they needed to work with their North Korean counterparts, and that the National Security Council did not meet a single time in advance of this summit meeting. So it was a perfectly styled Trumpian pageant that functioned as a presidential level summit on a critical set of national security issues. Therefore, I think we have to take the fact that the joint declaration is fairly empty and that the United States has not at this time pocketed any meaningful concessions as a proof of concept of this broader approach to Trumpian foreign policy. We have seen the president very successful at breaking agreements in the last couple of years and indeed in just the last several weeks, but we have not seen this incredibly chaotic approach to global affairs result in anything tangible or meaningful. In fact, I think it is not too much to assert that Kim Jong-un came away with a far more tangible set of gains than the United States of America did. So I hope that listeners and those processing this broader coverage will keep this in mind. This is not just about a particularly pompous circus-like summit in Singapore. It is a broader avatar for Trump's foreign policy in general and what it really can, or in this case, cannot produce.
Let me just follow up on one thing that Mira said by drilling down into a piece of the agreement that hasn't actually got a lot of attention. And it's one that's got to be treated with a lot of delicacy because it really does get to families that are involved in this longstanding tragedy on the Korean Peninsula. And that's the question of the return of remains. And this is something that you could tell that President Trump had a strong personal interest in. He said he had received a lot of communications on it, and he touted it as a big win. But if you look at this in the context of the broader strategic objectives that the United States has in Northeast Asia, you have to say that this is a focus on an issue of the base that actually could be a distraction. I mean, to the extent that the United States is making concessions in order to get human remains back, raises the question of whether the balance of priorities is right. And so I think this also demonstrates a feature of the president's diplomacy, which follows what Mira says, which is this idea that by appealing to narrow constituencies that are crucial to the president, that's the definition of a win rather than a broader objective. And I think this is one way in which the president can knock off course a team which in principle is capable of reaching these sorts of agreements. I disagree with the idea that we're so hollowed out that we don't have the expertise to do that. I think that Secretary Pompeo is actually right on this point. But if the president isn't backing the negotiation teams and driving a hard bargain, then the bargain is not going to get driven.
When we look at what happens next, it seems to me the optimistic scenario is that this is the start of a process, and maybe that process should have happened before the summit, but the summit kind of kickstarts a process in which a lot of these issues get thrashed out. On the other hand, you could argue that it's the whole thing is a flash in the pan, done mostly for show. Steph, what are you looking for over the coming few weeks in order to evaluate how to think about this summit in the longer term?
Well, clearly, we have to have some sense of what the diplomatic process is going to look like. And there's nothing that I could see, and I mean literally nothing, in the Singapore summit that gives any clues of what that's going to look like. Obviously, there's going to have to be follow-on. This meeting at this level was one of the first. You had two meetings that Secretary Pompeo undertook with Kim Jong-un directly, and then you had the team that Mira referred to, led by Sung Kim. But this is a process which is going to go on for months, if not even years. Just think of the things that have to be covered. We need to get a declaration from the North Koreans, a declaration that encompasses the sites, the stocks of fissile material, the stocks of weapons themselves, the delivery systems. We need to get inspectors on the ground. We need to negotiate some sort of more formal rather than informal freeze. That freeze would have to cover production, research, the Yongbyon site. It's just an extremely complicated set of negotiations. And until we see what the process looked like, it's impossible to know how far along we are.
Mira, what do you think? As over the next month or so, what are you looking for in terms of summit fallout?
Well, exactly as Steph mentioned, if this were to go forward as a denuclearization process, there would be so many incredibly important steps that it's really quite dizzying. So what I'm looking for is to see whether some sort of follow-on process is immediately invoked, which is to say that do we see mobilization and empowerment of some of these actual veteran experts who were doing the preparatory work on the ground in the last 2 weeks leading up to the summit? Sung Kim, Allison Hooker from the National Security Council, Randy Shriver at DOD, the onboarding to this team of nuclear weapons and arms control experts who were until this moment not involved in summit preparations at all. Do we see a process taking shape whereby this incredibly big set of commitments could be carried forward in something that begins to approximate the material circumstances that would be required to begin invoking the type of process that Steph described? There is no question that if we were actually living in a world where denuclearization is in the offing, this would take years. And it would not be a bilateral U.S.-North Korea issue. It would quickly come to involve the international community and international organizations, namely the International Atomic Energy Association. But before any of that could happen, the United States team would need to be built out and sustained in a way that did not happen before the summit. So if we don't see that happening quickly with energy and with the political backing of the White House, I don't think we should maintain much optimism for what remains an incredibly lofty and ill-defined goal.
But what if the outcome is just that we have gone from a situation where there was regular testing of missiles, regular, semi-regular testing of nuclear weapons, to a situation in which there is not those things, and we have an extended, drawn-out set of conversations of varying degrees of optimism over long periods of time? Is that a win or a loss?
Well, I would say it's a loss unless there are steps taken to gradually reduce the underlying capabilities and to make corresponding steps on the United States that would normalize relations. Basically, the world you're talking about could be interpreted as one in which the United States acknowledges North Korea as a de facto nuclear power over some very extended time frame and just seeks to contain it. I'm actually confident that the United States can do that. I don't think the risks are necessarily as great as others think, but that's not what we set out to do, and that's certainly not what I would prefer. I would prefer to see a process which led to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, however you want to define that, and the construction of some sort of security architecture that would lower risk.
Mira, what do you think? Is there any argument that that's a win because we were in a bad place a couple of years ago.
Look, there is no question that it's better to have the temperature lowered than it is to be on the precipice of war. That said, that is not the only thing that has changed over the course of the past year. And something that Steph and I have discussed here and through other venues is the sanctions coalition against North Korea, a very rigorous set of efforts that this administration should be given credit for, both unilaterally and more importantly at the United Nations, where they were able to put in place a set of sanctions, in particular secondary sanctions, that put more economic bite on the North Korean economy than any previous effort has ever achieved. But part of what has happened over the course of the approach to the summit, and now almost certainly as a result of the summit, is that that pressure coalition has disintegrated. Between the meetings with the Chinese leader, President Xi Jinping, Kim Jong-un has essentially already secured for himself promises that the Chinese will, on a de facto basis, begin to take economic pressure off North Korea. And we've seen reports just since the summit has been ongoing that the South Koreans are inclined to do the same. Essentially, Kim's ostensibly good behavior has broken up the international coalition that helped to create some of the pressure that may have created this diplomatic opening in the first place, and has subsequently ensured that there will not exist that same leverage to put pressure back on him going forward. Which is all to say that the question of whether diplomacy is better than where we were before has to be measured against what other types of diplomatic outcomes might have been possible, as Steph said. I find it hard to believe that with the sanctions pressure coalition that had been put in place, the United States did not have it at its disposal to secure something more concrete than what we got out of Singapore yesterday.
That provides an excellent basis on which to wrap up. So I want to ask each of you to conclude with a succinct statement of what, in your judgment, both the United States and North Korea gained, lost, and missed, and what opportunities they missed in the months leading up to this summit. As in, like, if we think about this in, I've never read The Art of the Deal, but in very Trumpian deal-making terms, who gained what here? Steph, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think Kim Jong-un came out of this a winner. There's just no question about that. I downplayed the whole question of the legitimacy that he would gain as a result of holding this summit, in part because I thought that the United States would come in with adequate leverage to hold his feet to the fire on the key issues, the missile and nuclear program. But we didn't see that. And so we have to hope that that will be put in place through the type of mechanisms that Mira and I have been talking about. On the Trump side, on the U.S. side, I just don't see us as having gained that much, or at least not having gained that much that is currently in the public domain. I guess the best we could hope is that more got accomplished at the closed bilateral that included the broader teams, that there are other things that we haven't seen yet. There is a commitment to some process, but right now that's just prospective. We haven't seen it.
Mira?
This is pretty clearly a win for Trump, only in the terms in which he likes to define winning and deal making, which is to say primarily in terms of his sort of ego and interpersonal needs, right? He, by the time the summit kicked off, had defined downwards, had moved the goalposts to suggest that if he could establish a relationship with Kim Jong-un, that would be historic. So in those purely Trumpian terms, his mission was accomplished, and we could all expect that that was going to be so. Personal diplomacy, of course, can be useful in its own right, but the Trump team just a few weeks before had laid out metrics that would have suggested that the Singapore summit should have at least initiated a process that could result in an arms control regime more rigorous than the Iran deal, and we are a very long way from the outcome. In the process of redefining this victory, Trump has also, as Steph suggested, handed an enormous win to Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather yearned for the type of presidential level summit that he had in Singapore, the chance to meet the U.S. president on equal footing, indeed legitimating not only the regime, but its nuclear arsenal by way of making no meaningful concessions. And along the way, he won the supposed cancellation of the U.S.-South Korean military exercises, as well as this sort of general perception that he is a, you know, gregarious, buoyant leader who everybody should take selfies with and find very entertaining, as opposed to quite a bloody and brutal dictator who oppresses his own people. Meanwhile, he's walking away with an economic situation that's likely to improve rapidly and is unlikely to turn against him meaningfully again in the coming weeks and months. So the upshot of all of this, I think, is that both men got the grandiose spectacle they were hoping for. Both men got relatively few concrete commitments, with Kim getting more than Trump. And in that way, Trump won only as he defines diplomacy, which is incredible pageantry and very little substance to speak of.
On that cheerful note, we'll wrap up. Mira, Steph, thanks so much for joining us again. And I have this sense that we will do it again pretty soon.
Our pleasure.
Great to talk to you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Mira and Steph for joining us on short notice. We rely on word of mouth to grow our audience, and it really makes a difference. So if you haven't yet, please take a moment to tell your friends about us on social media and give us a rating and review wherever you found us. Our audio editor is Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.